You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I'm so excited to present the live show. You guys finally get to hear it this week. I think you're really going to love it. A couple things I want to tell you first. First is... the first few minutes of the audio on this one are a little rough. Here's the reason. When I come out, I'm not on mic. I'm standing in front of the microphone. I'm at the edge of the stage just talking to the audience. So I sound like I'm in a cave. Don't worry. That's just the first couple of minutes. As soon as the show officially begins, I walk around. I'm on mic and then audio is beautiful. So don't get too distracted by that. The second thing is, you're going to hear me. Okay, so, all right. Something a little weird happened. And this is not something that I expected, but, well, two weird things happened. The first one I talk about, and you'll hear me talk about it in the show. Okay? As I'm beginning, I draw everyone's attention to a door that's at the back of the stage. But in the Earl Gallery, where we did the show, you can see it. And it's a, you know, it's a small place, so everyone could sort of see this door. And what I did was I related a story that Michael Monk, who is the site manager, told me. He said 2 days before we did our live show, he had tried to enter this storeroom, this little kind of closet area at the back of the stage. And he opened the door and it opened a few inches and then bumped up against all of these boxes that had been moved up against the door. The strange thing being that there was no access other than that door to this room, so that there would be no physical way for a human being to push boxes up against that door and then still get out of the room. A very weird thing, right? He literally had to take the door off the hinges to then access the room, push the boxes out of the way, put the door back on. It was a big deal. And he has no idea how it happened. Now, what's weird about this is that when he explained it to me and told me what happened, I recognized that something very similar happens in the book that I was talking about for the live show. So I thought that was really strange. And I tell the audience at the live show to be ready for it. I tell them the story and then I'm like, listen for the moment when in our episode tonight, you hear the same thing. Okay. Now, second weird thing, Kevin Ducey, our sound engineer, was there live recording everything. So in the aftermath of the live show, he is going through cleaning up the audio and just, you know, checking to make sure everything sounds good. And he sends me a text that basically says, when you get to the point in the story where you talk about how a door won't open all the way into a room because something is blocking it, there's a sound anomaly. I don't know where it's from. It's not the normal kind of thing I encounter in live recordings, but it's there, and it's right at that point in the story. Nothing happened while we were there. There was no strange thing that any of us were aware of. It was only apparent on the recording when he listened to it later. And when he played it back for me, I heard it too, and you guys will hear it too. Okay, so now you know what to look for. It's about 22 minutes in from when the show starts, okay? But you'll know when it happens, and you can go back and listen again and see if you can hear the anomaly and figure out what it was. Oh, and there's one more thing. This is actually the scariest thing. So during the intermission, there's a friend of mine who is a psychic medium and who communicates with the dead and who can sometimes see the dead. I had stopped by in the audience area, was talking to her, and she said to me, there was a man on stage behind you the entire time. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, he was standing right over there. It's a small stage. She's pointing to a spot about 4 feet behind me and to the left. And she said, he was watching you intently and he appeared to be listening. And I said, was this someone that was connected to me or someone connected to the place? And she says, I think it was connected to the place. So anyway, do with that what you will as you listen to this show. But the whole thing just kind of got very creepy. Anyway, one last thing before we start. We now have merch available. So we've got mugs, we've got tote bags, t-shirts, hoodies. Check it out at tinyurl.com/RHPBshop. That's tinyurl.com/RHPBshop. Between now and Halloween, you can get all this stuff for about 10% off. So check out our merch store and start your Christmas shopping early. Okay, if you're ready, I'm ready. Let's hear the live show. Here we go.
I'm spilling all over myself. Things are getting crazy. We packed everybody in. Does everyone who needs a seat have a seat? Okay, thank you. We had more people show up than we expected, which is insane. Thank you all for coming. My name is Susan Lambert, also known as Susan Lambert Haddam. I am Richard's other half and the producer of Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. I so appreciate you guys coming out on a Thursday, and I want to get to it. So, Kevin, are we ready? Are you ready, Nima? Okay. Are you guys ready? I would like to introduce to you guys Richard Haddam of Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf.
I want to thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it so much. Please give me a call. Before we start, I would like to thank, obviously, Susan Lambert. I would also like to call out the other producers of the show. Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, Tess Feifel, please give them a hand. Our designer, Tommy Beaver, our website designer, Kayla Lohr, and of course, some people we have here with us. Please welcome our sound engineer, Kevin Ducey, right here. And as always, our music, Nina Casarini. And stop.
Scott,
you have a last name, right?
Barber.
Barber?
Yeah.
Scott Barber, all right. And helping us set all this up today was Mike Lucas and Spira Skenzos. Sailor Franklin. Michael Monk, who is basically the sort of the owner proprietor of this place, told us a very scary story about something that happened at this door. I'm going to tell you what happened, and then I want you to listen to the case we're discussing. Here's what happened 2 days ago. He tried to open that door, he couldn't. Everything in that room had been pushed up against the door. There's no other access. No one inside the room could have done it and still get out of the room. That happened 2 days ago, and I can't help but think it has something to do with what we're going to talk about tonight. So keep in mind, as we're discussing tonight's case, opening a door 6 inches can't go any further. All right, keeping that in mind, finally, I want to thank two my last guys, Spencer Gerber Haddon and Dashiell Haddon. Yeah. Are we ready? Kevin, you ready? You guys ready? Ready. All right, in that case, here we go.
The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist by Jenny Ashford and Tom Ross. Imagine being Tom Ross. It's 1982 and you're 13 years old. You live in San Diego with your mom. Your folks just got divorced and now your dad lives in Mississippi. Mom's dating a new guy, Ray, and you and Ray do not get along. You're being sent to military school. You describe yourself as repressed and tightly wound. You keep things bottled up. You're not a happy kid. Then, the week before Christmas, things take a turn. Your cousin, aunt, and uncle are going to spend the week at a rented condo in Mammoth Mountain, California. And they invite you to go with them. You've never been skiing before. Heck, you've never even seen snow. This is going to be great. You'll spend those glorious days leading up to Christmas skiing, playing Atari with your cousin Wes, and generally having the time of your life. But 24 hours later, you find yourself inside a nightmare. The condo you're staying in is haunted. Everyone is terrified, and needless to say, your dream vacation is ruined. Even worse, over the next few days, you'll realize that somehow, it's all your fault. The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist, Bleed Red Books, 2015, is an odd document. Part childhood memoir, part first-person adventure in the paranormal. It's barely 120 pages long. And it just might be the most important poltergeist book ever written. It's a story about grappling with fear and coming out on the other side a different person. Ultimately, for Tom, it's about growing up. Tom Ross is about my age, so it was easy for me to identify with him as he tells his story. If you had asked me when I was 13 if I wanted to spend Christmas in a haunted ski condo, I would have said, fuck yeah. So there's a creepy sort of wish fulfillment at work when I read the book, but that soon wears off as the reality of the situation asserts itself. Tom and his family experienced extreme supernatural phenomenon almost from the moment they entered the condo. Most poltergeist cases start slowly, almost imperceptibly, and then they gradually ramp up, reaching a peak anywhere from several weeks to several months later. Not this one. It starts bad and gets worse fast. Usually with vacation rentals, your biggest worry is whether the Wi-Fi is going to work. But a poltergeist, they must have booked this place through Scare B&B. I first read The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist in December of 2017 while staying in a rented condo in Mammoth. I know. But in my defense, it was all Susan Lambert's fault. You see, the very fact that we were in a condo in Mammoth was because three other families at our son Dashiell's school had planned this trip, and Susan, who was on the mom text chain, decided that we should go too. I, of course, was furious. Are you insane, booking us a trip from December 18th to the 22nd? Susan and I host a Christmas Eve party every year. Between planning that and Christmas shopping and everything else that has to be wrapped and cooked and decorated and lit up, it's usually a week of 16-hour days. And by the time Christmas is over, I'm stressed out and exhausted and miserable just the way God intended. Susan suggested that maybe if we thought of the holidays as a holiday and approached things with a little less psychotic energy, they would work out anyway. Really, Susan? Really? Just relax and let Christmas happen. Enjoy the season and not let it drive me crazy. I don't think so. Christmas was too important for me to enjoy it. I mean, it was going to be a nightmare, and that was that. Now, a few days before we were supposed to go, I got a phone call. Dad? It was my oldest kid, Owen, calling from Bennington College. Hey, Owen. Susan said you guys were going to Mammoth, and I'm actually getting home on Sunday, so I was wondering if it would be okay if I went with you? This actually sounded like a great idea. I don't know why, but having Owen along suddenly made the trip feel doable. There'd be another adult along, basically. So it might be less noticeable when I slipped away to do what I really wanted to do, which was sit in the condo in front of the fireplace with a drink in my hand and a book on my lap. If the place could rent me a Saint Bernard to curl up at my feet, it would be perfect. In any event, on December 18th, 2017, Susan, Owen, Dashiell, and I found ourselves driving 6 hours from Pasadena to Mammoth Mountain, exactly 35 years after Tom Ross and his family made the same journey. Now, I would love to say we ended up in the exact same condo that they did, but that just isn't the case. Didn't matter. I had the book, and as I started reading it late that night, a surreal, almost existential dread had already firmly taken hold of me. You see, something else happened earlier that evening. Just before Susan and I headed downstairs to have drinks and dinner with the other families, I got a call from my friend Scott Philbrook from the Astonishing Legends podcast, and he sounded scared. "Hey, man," he said. "So what do you think about that New York Times story?" I knew exactly what he was talking about. Just 2 days earlier, on December 16th, the New York Times made history by publishing a front-page article titled "Glowing Auras and Black Money, the Pentagon's Mysterious UFO Program." It generated an enormous amount of publicity because it felt like, for the first time, the existence of UFOs was being acknowledged by a branch of the government. It was as close to disclosure as many in the UFO community had ever hoped to see in their lifetime. The article was written by Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal, Two notable and respected journalists. Perhaps most unique of all, there was no sense of irony or condescending wink-wink in the tone of the report. A central pillar of mainstream media was actually taking the subject of UFOs seriously. Of course, all this happened in December of 2017. You have to remember how everything felt in 2017. Everything seemed weird and surreal and fake. And the role of the media in our lives had never been more in question or more suspect on both sides of the political aisle. Everyone was angry. Everyone was scared. Consensus reality itself seemed to have melted down into a kind of choose-your-own-adventure mentality. Something seemed weirdly inevitable, weirdly, of course, about the New York Times putting UFOs on the front page of their newspaper. What next? A zombie apocalypse? Sure, why not? Somehow at that precise moment in history, anything seemed possible, but not in a good way. And this was 2 years before COVID. Now, I'm always happy to hear from Scott, and our pre-Christmas phone calls have since become kind of a tradition, but there was something really unsettling about talking to him that night. It was obvious that this UFO story had really bothered him. "What's happening?" he said. "I have a feeling our world just changed." Great. Again. After hanging up with Scott, I could feel fear beginning to blossom inside me. Susan and I put on our heavy coats and headed out into the cold, dark, snowy night. I asked her what she thought about the New York Times article, and she reminded me that as a woman living in America in 2017, UFOs were the least of her problems. We spent the rest of the evening in a loud, crowded restaurant, eating pasta and pizza and drinking spicy margaritas with our friends. I didn't think about UFOs or the New York Times again, and that was just fine with me. Throughout my life, I've had a complicated relationship with fear. That's why we're all here. It's always been there. It was there before I knew what it was or why it was there, but it was there every day, even when nothing scary was happening. Early on, I realized it wasn't something I could just set down and walk away from. It was inside me, like a swarm of bees in my stomach. I couldn't banish them. The best I could hope for them to get tired and settle down for a while. But almost anything could set them swarming again, and I never knew what. I needed a way to deal with my fear, to manage it, control it. Since my fears weren't going away, I decided to lean into them. Decided's the wrong word. I just did it. I don't know why. Instead of running away from fears, I would run right at them. Like Winston Churchill said, "When you're going through hell, keep going." This became my reaction to fear. I'd whip myself up into a state of emotional arousal so high that I wanted more than anything just to throw myself at the object of my fear. Roller coasters, public speaking, dark rooms, my mom. Maybe if I vanquished every fear, I'd prove to myself that I could survive. This forced bravery blasted me through high school plays and asking girls out and writing scripts and sending them out and facing rejection and doing stand-up comedy and truly believing, even when I really didn't, that I could succeed and be happy one day. The key was simple. Just never let fear stop me from doing anything, ever. Tom Ross faced real supernatural fear on December 22nd, 1982. As soon as he and his aunt Lois and Uncle Red and cousin Wes crossed the threshold of their Mammoth Mountain condo, they all felt a heaviness, quote, like you were walking into a weird high-pressure zone. Uncle Red and Aunt Lois felt it too. The only one who seemed unfazed was Tom's cousin Wes. And for the record, it almost feels as if Wes was in some sort of a fugue state throughout this entire affair. He spends a lot of time sleeping and never really seems hooked into the strange goings on. Now, this might strike you as unlikely, but as it turns out, it's extremely common that one person in the family experiencing a poltergeist, usually it's the dad, seems to almost not notice what's happening. Like some deep denial survival mechanism is at work that keeps them safe from the haunting. Anyway, everyone quickly went about choosing their bedrooms. The ground floor had three bedrooms and two bathrooms. The upper floor had the living room, kitchen, dining room, and master bedroom suite. Tom chose a bedroom on the ground floor, closest to the front door. He put his duffel bag on the bed, then went outside to the car to get more stuff. When he came back, after what he says was only a few seconds, his duffel bag was opened and his clothes were strewn across the bed. What was his reaction to this? Well, he immediately told himself that he must have started unpacking himself and simply forgot. Forgot in a matter of seconds. Again, an example of what really happens when the paranormal shit jumps off. People don't embellish it, they deny it. This is what the skeptics always get wrong. Something impossible happens, so you deny it so that things make more sense, not less. Doesn't matter. This was only the beginning. By the next day, nobody was denying anything. They were too busy trying to keep track of what their invisible housemate was up to. That night, as Tom tried to fall asleep in his downstairs bedroom, he remembers hearing a faint tinkling sound coming from inside the closet, like wire hangers were brushing against each other. Must be the wind, he thought. Then he heard a kind of shuffling noise, like something heavy was being slowly dragged across the carpeting toward him. Tom closed his eyes, too scared to look and see what might be making the noise. And can a single one of you blame him? The noise stops. Now the silence builds. Tom strains to hear the slightest sound, and what he finally hears is the soft rattling sound of the receiver on the phone on the nightstand being lifted by who? What? He hides under the covers, just inches from the phone. Then he hears someone, something, gently set it back. He musters every ounce of courage he possesses and peers out from under the covers. No one is there. This isn't pretend. This is really happening. And it's going to get so much worse. The next morning, the whole family goes skiing, and Tom is perfectly willing to put down everything that has happened so far to either his imagination or some other kind of misinterpretation. So he doesn't tell anyone about the strange sounds he heard in his bedroom the night before. Hey, he's 13. He's not a little kid. He isn't going to go to the grown-ups and start crying about the condo being haunted. But later that day, when he and Uncle Red return from the slopes, things inside the condo have changed. Small washcloths and tiny bars of hotel soap are laid out in strange configurations in the various bedrooms. At first, they thought the condo must come with some sort of housekeeping service. But when they check the contract, it clearly states housekeeping will only be done before they arrive and after they leave. Plus, this was some pretty weird housekeeping. The washcloths were laid at the foot of the bed, sort of hanging over the edge. And the soaps were placed on the pillows, the way some fancy hotels will leave chocolates on the bed as part of the turndown service. Later, when Lois and Wes return to the condo, Red and Tom show them the washcloths and say it feels like something weird's going on. They all decide to check each room and see if anything else seems strange. They start with the bedroom at the end of the hall, downstairs. When they look inside, they see a large, heavy wooden bunk bed. And next to it, one of the ugliest lamps they've ever seen. Across the room is a drafting table with a high drafting stool. The stool is pulled out a little bit from the drafting table, and a washcloth is draped over the back. Weird. They close the door and they go to check the next bedroom, when suddenly Red says, "Hey, wait, we gotta stop. We should memorize the exact position of everything in every room. Okay, that way they'll know if even the slightest thing has changed." Tom recalls the total elapsed time from leaving and then going right back to open the door was maybe 3 seconds. I mean, we're talking a few paces, 3-4 seconds at most. When they go back and open the door, no one can believe what's happened. The ugly table lamp has completely vanished. And the huge wooden bunk bed, it's now in the middle of the room. All of this in 3 seconds. Tom's no longer worried about looking like a scared little kid. He screams and runs out of the condo. Tom refuses to sleep downstairs that night. As he's getting set up on the couch in the living room, everyone suddenly hears an extremely loud sound from downstairs, like metal scraping across wood. Uncle Red goes downstairs to investigate. He heads straight for the bedroom at the end of the hall. He gathers his courage and opens the door to go inside, but the door won't open. It's bumping up against something. It's the bunk bed. It has now moved all the way across the room and is sitting just 6 inches inside the door. Tom sees his uncle come back upstairs, walk straight back into the master bedroom, and close the door. From there, he listens to his aunt and uncle have an urgent conversation that escalates into something like a fight. Merry Christmas. It's our first morning in Mammoth. Susan, Owen, Dashiell, and I ride the green egg-shaped gondolas from Mammoth Village up to the ski slopes. It's been more than 10 years since I've been skiing, but I remember loving it, and I'm excited to try it again. We get set up with skis and a snowboard for Owen, and before you know it, we're ready to hit the slopes. Susan and I shuffle along the line for the ski lifts. We finally scoot forward and get ready for our chair to scoop us up, and off we go. And then something happens. About 20 seconds into the lift ride, the bees in my stomach come to life. This is an understatement. I'm not experiencing anxiety. I'm experiencing terror. At this point, I'm 30 or 40 feet above the ground. Now, I've done this before. I've enjoyed this before. But now I'm plunged into fear like I haven't felt in years. I glance forward. We have miles to go. I look down. The ground is dropping out from beneath me even further. I should not have looked. This was all a terrible mistake. How could I have allowed this to happen? And I'm trapped, and there's no turning back. Somehow, I'm going to have to endure this, and it's not going to be over anytime soon. I close my eyes. I wrap my arms around the metal bars and secure myself as best I can. I won't fall. But will the chair fall? Of course not. These lifts have been running for years without fail. No one else is scared. If it was dangerous, they wouldn't be designed to look so clearly unsafe. We're fine. It's fine. Look down there, Susan says. There's Owen. Uh-huh, I say. Susan looks at me, or I assume she does, during the silence that follows. Are you okay, she says. Yes, I'm fine, I say. Why don't you shut up? I try to steady my breathing, just long breaths in and out. Closing my eyes really helps. My other senses aren't good at relaying height to my brain. I can't taste height. I can't smell height. Weirdly, I can hear it. People's voices sound so far away down below me. I don't like it. I plug my ears, but my hands are busy forming a death grip on the restraining bar. By now, Susan knows I'm in distress. How much farther do you think we have? I ask her. Oh, not much. Okay, this is bad. Don't panic. Oh God, don't panic. Panic will make you fall. You're fine. It's fine. Susan says, you're okay. The way she talks to our dog, Bowie, when we take him to the vet. And I am okay. I'm going to be okay. And then there's a sudden jerk, and the chair swings backward and forward in a whole new series of terrible sensations. And I can feel myself starting to cry because we've stopped. And now we're just hanging there, and this is so much worse than moving. I feel so humiliated, so helpless. I trust Susan more than I trust anyone in my life, so I try to focus on how not afraid she is. She has complete faith in the people who built this. But then I find myself thinking, how intelligent is Susan really? Sure, she seems to have confidence in this chairlift, but it's not like she's got a degree in structural engineering. doesn't have any special knowledge to back up her trust in this spindly, ill-shaped machine straight out of a Dr. Seuss cartoon. What if just this once, she's wrong? Chunk. We start to move again. Okay, we've been up here, what, 6-8 hours? We gotta be close to the end. I ask Susan to please just let me know when it's time to get off. She says, okay, don't open your eyes. Don't open your eyes yet, but we're getting close, but not yet. I start to calm down. Okay, we're almost there. I open my eyes. And we're still at least 100 yards out. I'm floating in midair thousands of feet over the ground. I clamp my eyes shut. Why did you tell me to open my eyes? I didn't, she says. I said, we're almost there. My anger at Susan almost overwhelms my terror. Then I hear Susan say, okay, and I feel her jump out of the chair. What the fuck? I open my eyes and we have arrived. In fact, if I stay on the lift even a second longer, I'll end up being stuck on this thing all the way back down again. I hurl myself out of the chair. I face plant into the snow. My mouth is filled with ice. I'm missing a ski. I look up at Susan with, I'm gonna say murder in my eyes. Wow, you're fun, she says. She waits patiently for me to get my shit together, and then we make our way to the top of the run. She starts down, gracefully slicing narrow arcs in the fresh powder. I watch her. And then I slowly, carefully follow my skis at a pizza point. I'm passed on the right and the left by people trying to enjoy themselves, if only this clearly mentally disturbed adult would get off the slopes. 10 minutes later, I deposit myself at the bottom of the run. But instead of turning left for the ski lift, I turn right for the bar. My time for skiing is over. For the next few days, Tom Ross and his family have the worst, weirdest, scariest vacation of their lives. The poltergeist activity is non-stop. The hanging lamp over the staircase swings in a circle constantly, only stopping long enough to start up again in the other direction. Tom and his Uncle Red begin trying to communicate with the ghost, or the blost, as they started calling it as a sort of code word. In light of what happened later, they both now realize this was probably a terrible idea. They would stand outside the master bedroom and ask the blost to perform some feat. Move a washcloth from the bed to the chair, that sort of thing. Then they'd close the door and wait. As soon as the hallway lights flickered, something they came to recognize as a signal, they'd open the door and see what had happened. Tom recalls, a lot of times it would do what we asked or something close to what we asked. It was scary, but at the same time, it was sort of incredible that we were able to interact with it like that. Many of the items that appeared in the room were not present to begin with. Again, Tom, quote, sometimes they were objects that came from downstairs. They would just appear there in a second, and they hadn't passed us. They hadn't come up the staircase and gone through the hallway and through the closed door that we were standing outside of. So we don't know how they got in there. Either they teleported or somehow matter was passing through other matter. I don't know. This, as it turns out, is not uncommon in poltergeist cases. Tom decides he wants to see the blost move something with his own eyes. He goes inside the master bedroom, stands on the rocking chair, and places a washcloth high up on the curtain rod. Then as he walks out of the room, he turns back quickly, hoping to catch the blost in the act. The first two times he turns back, the washcloth is still in place. But the third time, it is gone. Both he and Red look around confused when suddenly Red shouts, "There it is, in your back pocket." Indeed, just like a stage magician, the blost has pulled off an impressive trick. Neither Tom nor Red had seen this happen. It didn't just happen quickly. It had happened instantaneously. As their fear of what the blost was capable of deepened, Tom and his family discussed leaving the condo. But all the roads in and out of the ski valley were closed because of persistent snowfall, so going home wasn't an option. Instead, they stayed in the condo like prisoners. Hoping that things would stop and growing more and more desperate when they didn't, there wasn't much joy that Christmas. The vacation ultimately became about emotional survival. No one slept, or at least not well. They tried to distract themselves with TV and games, but they could never forget that they weren't alone in the condo. The Blost wouldn't let them. It didn't want them to forget. It demanded to be noticed. It wasn't until the day after Christmas that the weather finally broke enough to allow them to leave. And when they did, it was with great relief. They all truly believed they were leaving Mammoth Mountain and their Blost behind forever. They would soon learn how wrong they were. I sit in the bar at the ski lodge, sipping my scotch and staring outside at the snowy mountaintops in the distance and wondering how I let myself become a person ruled by fear. Can people tell I'm a coward just from looking at me? Probably. My scotch is actually a cocktail called a Nutty Geisha. It's pink, and I could have done without the gardenia. Also, it's served in a hollowed-out coconut with a lit sparkler. And maybe no one will notice. What happened, I wonder? When I got on that ski lift, I was fine, and then suddenly, I wasn't. The suddenness of the fear was almost worse than the fear itself. I thought I knew myself, and now at age 51, I was forced to realize that maybe I didn't. I feel myself descend into shark mode. I go a little dead inside, and I can feel adrenaline dumping into my veins. I have to get back on the chairlift, because if I don't, I never will. You don't let fear control you. You do not let it get the upper hand, because once you do that, you're finished. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Okay. I set down my coconut, clamber outside in my boots, and put on my skis. And with a pounding sick pain in my stomach, I head back to the ski lift line, because this is what you do. Because if you don't, you don't exist anymore. Because feeling fear and then conquering it and then feeling it again over and over again is everything. It is your life. It is what you do. It is who you are. I ride the ski lift 3 more times that day. Always with total strangers, always with my eyes clamped shut, always with renewed regret. It never gets easier. In fact, it gets worse. And by the end of the day, my blood is sick with adrenaline and my entire body aches with fear. There is a big difference between a ghost and a poltergeist. A ghost typically haunts a place, but a poltergeist haunts a person. This person is referred to as an agent or a focus. And the reason the book is called The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist and not The Mammoth Mountain Ghost is because as soon as Tom and his family got back home to Aunt Lois and Uncle Red's house, they discovered the Blost had made the trip with them. Within the first hour of being back home, the Blost made it clear he was here to stay. Vases changed positions on the mantle. Hot Wheels scooted themselves across the floor. A large kitchen knife sailed through the air and then vanished completely before reappearing later in a bedroom down the hall on the bed. It's one thing to stay in a haunted condo for a few days, but when the haunting invades your own home, your most intimate, personal, safe space, the intrusion becomes intolerable. Now, at the time, Tom and his family didn't know the difference between a ghost and a poltergeist. All they knew was that they were scared and exhausted, and they wanted it all to stop. Red began having deep misgivings about engaging with this strange force in the way that they did. Was it their fault the ghost followed them home? With this in mind, they all actively decided to ignore what was happening inside their home on the general assumption that they were somehow feeding it with their reactions, and if they ignored it, it would grow bored. This method hadn't worked up in Mammoth, but maybe it would work here, and the Blost would finally just go back home. The one person who couldn't ignore the blowst was Tom. Because on some deep personal level, he knew that everything that was happening because of him. It was all his fault. But then, that was a feeling he was used to. His parents' divorce, his mother's moods. One way or another, bad stuff always led back to him. And as usual, he was not only the cause of the problem, but also the one suffering the most from its results. The next two nights that Tom spent at his aunt and uncle's house were the most terrifying of his life. The first night, he was camped out alone in Wes's room. He was so frightened and guilt-ridden by the idea that the blowst had followed them home that he zipped himself completely up in his sleeping bag and stayed curled inside, unable to see anything in the room. But he could still feel things. And what he felt was something soft hit the outside of his sleeping bag near his face and then dragged slowly across the outer nylon surface all the way from his head to his feet. This happened again and again for what felt like hours. Finally, stress and exhaustion overcame him and he fell asleep. When he woke up the next morning and emerged from the sleeping bag, he found every drawer in the room open and every article of Wes's clothing piled up at the foot of his sleeping bag. That's what he was feeling. The poltergeist had been removing clothes from the drawers and then dragging them across his body before dropping them on the floor. The next night was even worse. Again, he hid inside his sleeping bag with his eyes clenched shut, but now instead of feeling something, he heard something. It sounded like an air bubble releasing from an office water cooler, a sort of blunk sound. Because the sound was familiar, he stuck his head out of the sleeping bag to see what had caused it. It seemed to be coming from a spot in mid-air, about 3 feet off the ground and just to his right. The sound kept rising and falling in volume and morphing into a longer, more sustained noise, like a voice struggling to form words underwater. The low, choking moan grew more insistent. It was just a few feet from him, and he was suddenly sure that whatever it was trying to speak to him. But Tom did not want to hear whatever it had to say. He ran out of the room, dragging his sleeping bag behind him, and spent the rest of the night in his aunt and uncle's room on the floor at the foot of their bed. I've always believed that kids grow up slowly and then suddenly, all at once. I know I did. And I think that's what happened to Tom on December 28th, 1982. It began when Tom realized that he knew which objects in the house were going to move just before they did. The way he describes it, he noticed that a certain object would develop a halo around it. It would distinguish itself from surrounding objects. It would, quote, make itself known. And just as Tom became aware of it, it would move. At first, he thought whatever was doing this was reading his mind. It was noticing him, noticing something, and then moving it. Tom didn't know it, but he was so close to the breakthrough. It finally happened later that day, and when it did, it involved a bottle of aftershave. He was in his aunt and uncle's bathroom, and he found himself staring at a bottle of Jovan Musk for Men. A classic relic of the early 1980s. It was an 8-ounce bottle, which is about 7.5 more ounces of Jovan Musk for Men than any human being would ever need in a lifetime. To him, in that moment, the bottle looked hyper-real. Tom thought to himself, that's the next thing that's going to move. He turned around and walked out of the bathroom and then a few steps down the hall. He quickly turned back and saw the bottle of Jovan Musk on the floor in the hallway, right behind him. And that's when the light bulb went off. What if the blowst wasn't reading his mind? What if he had been moving things with his mind the whole time without realizing it? What if he was the blowst? He decided to try an experiment. He concentrated on moving the bottle of Jovan Musk, first back into the bathroom and then into the kitchen. He closed his eyes and focused as hard as he could. He imagined the power coursing through his body and then bursting outward, moving objects with his mind. The result surprised him. When he opened his eyes, the bottle of musk was still there, sitting on the floor. In fact, its movement from the bathroom to the hallway was the last thing the Blost ever did. It went away, and it never came back. When Tom tried to move something by himself, with his mind, the entire poltergeist experience ended. It just sort of collapsed in on itself. Tom sums it up like this. In the beginning, when I thought an outside entity was doing all of it, I could tell it to move something and it would do it. But the minute I realized, hey, maybe I did it, that's when it all stopped. I think I know how Tom Ross felt as a kid. He felt trapped. Trapped in an unhappy family situation, trapped at school. And when he finally got a little freedom, a power started growing inside him that he didn't really understand. At first it was fun, but it also scared him. But soon enough, he learned how to control the powers he had. The ones we each find for ourselves, sooner or later. The ones we spend the rest of our life learning how to control so they don't scare us or hurt others. As much as the Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist reads like a first-person account, it isn't. It's authored primarily by Jenny Ashford. Jenny met Tom at a nightclub in Orlando in 2010, and they began a relationship in the wake of her divorce. Tom and Jenny were both full-grown adults, well into their 40s when they got together. And like all people in a new relationship, they confided a lot of deep, dark secrets to each other. Tom had spent time in the military overseas, and the time he spent in active duty brought him face-to-face with experiences that affected him more deeply than anything else in his entire life, except for one thing. It was well after he told Jenny what he did in the war that he finally found the courage to tell her the story of the Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. Now, Jenny makes her living writing horror fiction and is a self-described skeptic. But when Tom told her about his experiences, she faced an all too common dilemma. And if I was hearing this story from anyone else but him, in the book, she tells the story of what happened in that creepy condominium with the appropriate amount of emotional detachment. She's not trying to debunk it. She's just trying to relate what four people agree happened 35 years earlier. And she has some emotional insight into the person telling the story. So I would say her authorial stance is solid. Even better, Tom found someone he could share his deepest fears with safely, and it brought them together. It didn't drive them apart. I know the sexy joy that happens when a haunted boy finally meets his haunted girl. So I'm going to call the Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist a love story, too. It's time we move beyond the conversation of whether or not poltergeists exist. I no longer feel that the endless relitigation of Enfield or Battersea or the proving of this case authentic or that one a hoax is a productive conversation. Poltergeist phenomenon has been going on forever. We know a lot about it. It's been studied in depth. If it were a disease, we'd know all the symptoms, who gets it, how long it lasts. The only thing we don't know is what causes it and how to stop it. Stories like the one about Tom, told by Jenny, move us forward in our understanding of the poltergeist. We've known for quite some time there's a human focus, but in Tom's story, for the first time, we learn about how the focus of a poltergeist case can, sometimes, control it. And isn't that something worth knowing? How to make the scary stuff stop. I finish the book at 2 a.m. and fall asleep. But don't worry, I'm up again by 4. Staring holes in the ceiling and worrying about all the things I can't control. Politics, the world, the safety of my children. In other words, I do what everyone does when they're awake at 4 a.m. I go to the bad place. And I know I'm doing it, and I know it's hurting me, and I do it anyway. Why? Why do we wake up in the middle of the night not thinking of paradise? Why don't we lie in bed remembering our best times, our victories, the moments we really helped someone else, the times we laughed so hard we couldn't breathe? In a couple of hours, I'm going to be back on that ski lift. I don't have a choice. We came here to ski, so I have to ski, even if it makes me sick. That's when I suddenly hear a noise in the living room. I listen carefully. I hear it again. A creaking sound and a soft thumping. I get out of bed and walk across the bedroom and then into the kitchen, where I find every single cabinet door standing open. Dad? I don't scream exactly. I make a sound like, but before I'm even finished spinning around, I know it's Owen. My throat really hurts, so I was looking for tea? Why were you looking for tea in the dark? I didn't want to wake up Dashiell. He's asleep on the couch. Owen is making it very difficult for me to be furious. After a few minutes, we find some tea, and together we make it. Owen says, I don't think I'm going skiing today. And I instantly know, I'm not either. Owen's not because of a sore throat, and I'm not because of a sore soul. Is that okay? If I choose not to ski, does that make me a loser? It's so easy for Owen to do the math. If you're sick, you don't ski. If you already feel bad, you don't do things to make yourself feel worse. No guilt, no self-judgment. How did I raise such a child? We talk for a little while longer, and then Owen goes back to bed, and so do I. As I lie in bed this time, a new thought occurs. I am 51 fucking years old, and you know what? I've done it. I've faced my fears, all right? I watched Dawn of the Dead when I was way too young. And The Shining. I've gone to auditions, and I've been in bad plays, and I've done stand-up alone in front of strangers, squinting into a spotlight and begging for love. I taught comedy traffic school every Saturday for 5 years, and those people did not want to be there. And I've done the career, the first drafts, and the meetings, and the agents, and the studios, and the networks, and the notes phone calls, and the actors, and the upfronts, and the ratings, and the cancellations. I've done marriages and a divorce. And I've paid alimony and child support and never missed a single month. I've flown on airplanes in sandstorms that shook me around like dice in a cup. I've run out of money and gone into debt and had to call my dad for help many, many times. So many I've lost count. I've received phone calls from third-level credit card debt collectors, one whose name, I'm not kidding, was Randy Press. And he wasn't friendly at all, and he wasn't kidding around. I've seen blood in my urine. I've been told my PSA numbers are too high, and we don't know why. I've had my mom tell me she has cancer. I watched her get sick, and I saw her die, and I survived growing up with her in the first place. Haven't I done enough, I think? Haven't I finally proven to myself and the world that I can endure? That in all the ways that matter, I haven't let fear control my life? How much more self-induced misery and terror do I need to put myself through? The New York Times is telling us the UFOs are real, and meanwhile, I can feel this country slipping into darkness. Maybe the idea now is to let myself off the fucking hook. There's so many assholes now, and they're so loud. Maybe I need to just back off social media and its knife jolts of stabbing anxiety and shift my focus to kindness, calmness, empathy, and mercy. Those are things I can control. Maybe fear isn't something I need to court. Maybe there's a victory in stepping around the potholes of hate and finding peace and love and grace and joy in the people around me. One by one, I feel the bees fly away. Dad? Jesus! What?
I just wanted to tell you that I found some coffee under the sink. Also, a coffee maker. If you and Susan want some coffee in the morning, fine. Hey, Owen, thank you. For sure. When Susan wakes up, I tell her, look, I'm really sorry. I don't think I'm going to go skiing today. Okay, she says, why don't you take yourself out to breakfast? She says this because she knows it's my favorite thing. And in this moment, I feel forgiven. I'm forgiving myself, but somehow it feels better if I think it's coming from her. I pick up my phone and check in on Scott. I'm pleased to discover he's no longer worried about the UFO article and has moved on to worrying about producing the Astonishing Legends podcast about the UFO article. Like me, Scott has found solace translating his fears into entertainment. And Tom Ross, whatever happened to him? Well, did he live out the rest of his life fear-free? I'm afraid not. His paranormal experiences continued. He ended up in the military, and while at Fort Campbell in 1994, he had a spontaneous out-of-body experience that was witnessed by his bunkmate, who saw his uninhabited body and later said, "You looked like you were dead." 2 weeks later, while riding his motorcycle, Tom was hit by a military vehicle and almost killed. He had a classic near-death experience, the white light communicating with the dead and other spirit beings, but he was told it wasn't his time, that there were things he needed to remember and do with the rest of his life. He was seriously injured in that accident, and it took more than 2 years for him to fully recover. He spent the intervening years researching the history of parapsychology, trying to find an explanation for the things that he had experienced. He now suspects that poltergeist activity is caused by what he calls a partial out-of-body experience. Here's what he says. The right hemisphere of the brain goes out and manipulates objects and does things, and the left, conscious side of the brain, is not aware that the right is exteriorized and doing all this. For want of a better word, it's part of the soul exteriorized. And it starts acting out and doing things, and it appears to be a ghost. Tom continues studying the paranormal to this day, bravely trying to unravel his own experiences. And even though in the aftermath of the motorcycle accident, he doesn't seem to be able to connect with the phenomenon personally, it hasn't stopped him from trying. He's reaching into the dark. His journey facing his own fears goes on. One thing is for sure, he's made of stronger stuff than I am. Later that morning, while Susan takes a shower, I go into the kitchen and make us some coffee. And I do something I never do on vacations. I turn on the television. A local station is playing a rerun of Barney Miller. It's the one where they all eat hash brownies. And I take it as a sign from God. Seek comfort, find peace, embrace joy. You don't have to go looking for the darkness. It will find you in its own good time. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Book Club.
Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time when we go all the way back to 1983 and talk about the first time I wrote a television script in high school and a couple other first-time experiences as we talk about the book Susie Smith's Voices of the Dead. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at FreeStyleLibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit MyFreeStyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.